Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Open Minds Radio with your host Alejandro Rojas.
Hello, everybody. It's good to be back. It's Alejandro Rojas, and you are listening to Open Minds Radio. And I'm putting in the chat right here. It's sweet now that we have our website up and everything. It's a one-stop shop in order to listen to the radio, in order to watch the radio over Ustream. All you have to do is go to openminds.tv/radio, or actually just go to openminds.tv and click on the radio link. So here is where you can see video, because many people were asking last week, how can we see the video? How can we see the video? And the video wasn't working last week, so you couldn't. But now you can, and look, there I am, and I'm so furry. I'm furry this week, and I was last week, and you probably won't see this next week. It's a long story, but I don't know why it makes me feel a little bit like the guy from Pearl Jam, and I can't remember his name, and I'm trying hard not to do it, but I'm going to have to do my impression. Alone, restless, breakfast table in an otherwise empty room. Sound just like him, don't I? Don't call me daughter, not fit to be. Anyway, we have a great guest today. We have Antonio Juneas, who I have the pleasure. Eddie Vedder, someone in the chat got his name. Thank you. That's who it is. Someone in the chat got his name right. But we have one of my coworkers here, Antonio Juneas, and it's a great pleasure. I have some great coworkers, some researchers who have been around for a very long time, decades. And Antonio is our guest in the studio, so if you're watching on the Ustream at openminds.tv, you're going to be able to see him here and some pictures of him in the past with some of the researchers he's worked with, which is just about everybody. He got to work on the Rockefeller Initiative. If you're a listener to the show, you've heard us talk about Lawrence Rockefeller and how he was looking into UFOs. Look, there he is. And then also, he was, some people don't know, you know, lately, I know Michael Sala, some others have made a big deal about possible back meetings at the UN, but there were meetings in the UN in the past, and Antonio was there. Also, Antonio's done a lot of research and even written a book on Russian UFO history and files, so we'll talk about that. So it's really exciting because Antonio's been here researching the phenomena for a very long time. Lots of great stuff to talk about, and I luckily get to sit a couple cubicles away from him, and the cubicle in between us is occupied by Maurizio Bayara, the editor-in-chief of the magazine that we're going to have out soon, I hear, and hopefully in the next week or two, but Antonio and him are working on that, and we'll have Maurizio on the show in a couple weeks. We can't have him next week because that's Thanksgiving, although having Maurizio on Turkey Day might be fitting. But we'll have him in a couple weeks because he's also done a lot of great stellar research. And you can read both of their stories, all of our stories that we write, on our webpage as well, on the front page of Open Minds. www.ourwebsite.tv. Speaking of our website, on the front page you'll also get our daily UFO headlines because, as I always emphasize, which I think is terribly interesting, is that UFOs are in the news all the time. All of these are links to conventional news, you know, regular newspapers out there, not UFO websites. Once in a while, I'll pop one of those in there when there's some big news on a UFO website, but that's rare. Typically, these are, you know, papers like the Washington Times, the Sun, biggest paper out there in London, or San Francisco Chronicle had one recently. Just all of these papers and local papers out there. Big news out there in Britain, of course, is always Gary McKinnon. You know, I always think, well, we won't be hearing from him for a few more weeks or a month or something because something new happens in his case. Of course, this was the UFO hacker we talk about every week. Well, now it's been nothing but bad news for the guy. All I've been doing is coming on the air and saying, Gary McKinnon, he's been let down again, but not actually that the MPs, the parliament in Britain have been fighting over him. And they actually are some of the groups in the parliament want to keep him from being extradited because of his health issues. I guess he's suicidal right now. They're afraid that if they send him to America, he's going to kill himself. And I got to say, come on. You know, if that's how you people in Britain think of America, it's not that bad. Although, American prisons, I guess I shouldn't say. They're probably pretty bad. Luckily, I wouldn't know, but I'm sure some of our coworkers. I wonder if Antonio knows. We'll have to ask him if he's done any hard time. But McKinnon might get off. He might. They're debating. They have the weirdest departments out there. They have the Home Office is one of the group of MPs, and I think they're the ones who don't want McKinnon to be. They want him to be extradited. And then there's Home Affairs. There's another group, and they don't want him to be extradited. So it's kind of weird out there in Britain, but they're fighting over it. So he might not go away. Lots and lots of sightings. Otherwise, you're going to see, you know, all over the place, some pictures and some UFOs in the UK, everywhere. However, I think this was an interesting story, and this is because it comes from, you know, where I used to live. But the balloon people. The people who hoaxed the balloon because they were on that wife swap and they were the UFO family, they pled guilty to the hoax charges. So they're no longer trying to pretend that they were innocent and they didn't hoax this whole thing. They've admitted, okay, it's a hoax, we're guilty. And hopefully, I think that allowed them to keep their children because they were in trouble of, you know, going to jail and having their children taken away from them. So I guess that it's looking like the wife will probably get off with not doing any time, but dad might spend some time in jail with Gary McKinnon talking UFOs. Maybe he'll finally get a talk, figure out the truth behind the UFOs there. And then finally, this is a neat story, and we can talk to Antonio, because Antonio, he speaks like several different languages. He's been all over the world, and I know he's got some insight into Chinese ufology, but this gentleman named Zhang Yifeng, who's a physics professor, he's actually, we were talking about a convention they had over there in China recently to talk about UFOs. This is a guy who put it on. But there's an interview online, and it's Chinese and subtitled, and you could read that. It's kind of cool because he's really into UFOs and everything and seems like a great guy. By the way, they get huge attendance at their UFO conferences out there. So, you know, you guys who are listening to the show, what's coming up? Laughlin, the UFO Congress, it's not that expensive. You know, you can roommate with someone. I'm going to be there. Antonio, Maurizio, and the whole Open Minds crew is going to be there. So come hang out with us. Come see us at the UFO Congress coming up here. Just go to ufocongress.com. It's a week-long UFO conference with all kinds of stuff going on. So even if you can just come for a couple days, it's definitely worth checking out. But enough about UFO news. That is everything fit to print. Let us talk about, let me put this out here again. video at openminds.tv for people who, because people are always in the blog top chat saying, how do I look at the video? Well, there's how you do it. And there's chat rooms in both places. If you want to listen on Blog Talk, you could go there, or if you want to come to openminds.tv and watch the video and chat, you can do that too. And look, there's Antonio right there. I can see him in the video. Antonio Huneos, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Alejandro. A pleasure.
Yep, it's a pleasure to have you. So it's been a lot of fun. Luckily, I've got to talk to you a bit about your history, but I want to go way back at first. And luckily, we have lots of pictures to show you way back. But I wanted to talk about how you first got involved with this whole thing.
Right. Well, really, I became involved already in the United States. I came to this country in 1975, even though I was born in New York, because my father was a Chilean diplomat and had worked at the United Nations. The first time that I even became exposed to the idea of UFOs was, like I guess millions of other people, I saw the Von Däniken movie at a downtown theater in Santiago, Chile, in 1972.
The Chariots of the Gods?
Chariots of the Gods, in Spanish is called Recuerdos del Futuro, Memories of the Future.
Mm.
And it kind of blew my mind. I had never thought of any of these things. I was a science journalist in Chile back in those days, and I was, I guess, somewhat open-minded with regard to parapsychology and archaeological mysteries, things like that I did write about, but not much about UFOs. I was pretty skeptical, and so I understand why people are skeptic, because I was once there.
Mm-hmm.
It's what I call skeptical by ignorance, as opposed to, you know, the professional debunker who...
Yeah, that's
knows,
a great term, I think.
Yeah, because that's exactly what I was. I knew very little about the subject, and I thought it was all bunk, basically. I mean, I knew the press reported on flying saucers, even in Chile, but I just didn't give much thought about it. And the reason I thought there was very little to it is because I was a science columnist for a weekly magazine, and I was dealing with scientists all the time. On various, you know, physicists, astronomers, you name it. And these people never talked about UFOs. So I assumed that since if UFOs were real, scientists would be all excited and on the trail of it. Since they weren't, that meant that there probably wasn't much about UFOs. So that was my attitude. I remember reading a book, which was put by a contactee in Peru. I visited Ganymedes, which was a bestseller. So I read it not because I was interested in the subject, but because it was a popular bestseller and everybody was reading it about. And it intrigued me. I remember after finishing the book, this would have been about 1974 maybe, going and we had a house in the beach, my family in near Santiago. And I remember looking at the skies, you know, looking for UFOs. And I had a telescope. I was into astronomy. But really, that was not my subject. Then I came to the United States in 1975, and I was in New York City. Well, initially I lived in Miami briefly and then in Washington, D.C., but eventually I moved to New York City by 76 actually. And in 77, my brother, one of my brothers in Chile, sent me these newspaper clippings about a very strange case of it's known as the Corporal Valdez case. Very mm-hmm. strange case happening with a military patrol in the north of Chile in the desert. And which was the oddest thing because I was not into the subject. So why didn't... It was kind of a destiny thing. He sent me these clippings. And on the same day that I received the clippings on the mail, of course, everything was done by post office mail back in those days. And I lived in the East Village in New York City, Manhattan. And I walked to a place called the Gem Spa, which was a famous newsstand in our neighborhood. And I see this alternative newspaper called the New York Daily Planet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the Daily Planet, like
right.
Superman. So I'm looking at it. It looked pretty cool paper. And it had a whole section on UFOs. And I said, oh, great. I just got this story from Chile. And I was trying to get inroads in journalism in the United States. And this looked like an alternative paper. You didn't need connections to get in. So I went and I wrote the story, basically. And my English wasn't too good, so my friends had to kind of edit the grammar. And I walked into the newspaper. The editor of the, and publisher was a guy called Mike Luckman, who I became friends with, and later was the author of this book called Alien Rock, mm-hmm. about the rock and roll stars and UFOs, which I also worked on, but that was like 30 years later. And he take a look at the article, and he said, great, I'll publish it. And so that became my very first UFO article.
And then did you continue to write for him?
I would have, except that they ran out of money and the paper closed.
Oh, no.
So, now, briefly, and I'm sure some of our listeners may be familiar with this case. It's quite
famous. I wasn't familiar with the case until you told me
about it.
It's old.
At the time, was in all over the... Well, even the National Enquirer did a big story at the time.
Yeah, it's a great case.
It's a very fascinating case. Basically, what you had a military patrol of seven soldiers and a corporal. And they were camping near some stables in the in a very remote area of Chile near the border with Bolivia. It's a high desert area. And they were sleeping. It was late at night, but one soldier was acting as a guard, as a watchman. And he sees this UFO that's coming down near the patrol. Actually, he sees two UFOs, but the other one is on the other side of the hill, and that, we don't know whatever happened to that one. But the other one comes near the patrol. So he wakes up all the, you know, his colleagues. And they're all scared because this thing is big and it's hovering and it's got blinking lights and all that. It's at night, so they cannot see very well the details of the shape of it. Now, the leader is the corporal. His name was Valdez, Corporal Valdez, or Armando Valdez. He tells the soldiers that they should all stick together. But later... He relates that he heard like a voice inside his brain, basically urging to walk towards the object. So even though he gives instructions to the soldier that should stay together, he walks towards the object. He disappears for about 20 minutes. It's not clear exactly how he disappeared. The soldiers see him walking towards the UFO, and then he's no longer there. Then this is where the story starts getting really strange. 20 minutes later, he reappears, but behind the patrol. Nobody saw him walking from the object towards the camp. Suddenly, he's behind. He's in a state of shock and near amnesia and stuff, and incoherent. Then the soldiers, and then he passes out. The soldiers notice two things that, you know, in the Army, well, you probably haven't been in the Army, but any of our listeners that have or people know this, you have to shave every day. You already be in trouble right now.
I'm more like, I've got the gorilla shape of heritage.
In the Navy, you can have beards, but at least in the British Navy.
Keep you warm on the
right. Yeah, I guess it's from the old days on the ship. Anyway, so he has a five-day growth on his beard. Mm-hmm. As a soldier, he had shaved the previous morning. Then they notice a second effect. He had a wristwatch. You know, remember the old wristwatches with a calendar? Mm-hmm. The clock had stopped after 15 minutes, but... somehow the date showed 5 days in the future. So you had a mechanical effect and a physiological effect.
Mm-hmm.
Now, later, about a 2 year, now maybe more, about 4 or 5 years, there was an attempt to debunk the story, because what happened is Valdez became a Christian fundamentalist, and so he said some strange things and so on. But mm-hmm. I don't think that invalidates, though, the original story. This was the time of the military dictatorship in Chile, mm-hmm. Pinochet. It was a very, very strict discipline, very Germanic type of organization, especially the army. And if these guys would have been lying, hoaxing, doing anything, they would have been immediately discharged, and nothing like that happened. The story eventually got out. It was published in all the press. As far as I know, the patrol were separated. They were sent to different regiments, which is common in other UFO stories. They don't want the people to stick together to reinforce their stories. And the soldiers were just doing the military service, so after 2 years or whatever, 1 year, they were back in civilian life. But the corporal was an army man, you know, he was doing a career, and he stayed in the army. Eventually, he became a sergeant, and he retired as a sergeant. So that alone tells me that there was something.
And the army, I guess, kept him from talking to the press?
Yes, at the time they did. What happened is the story got out. This is pretty strange, too. When right after the incident, the patrol were going back to the nearest town, which is called Putre, And from there, I guess, to go back to their unit and report the incident. However, the first person they met was not any official, but was a school teacher called Pedro Araneda, who happened to be interested in UFOs in the middle of nowhere. I mean, this would be like if you're in the, you know, in the desert in Arizona or New Mexico, somewhere in the middle of nowhere, and the one guy they meet, not only is, and he also had a tape recorder. It's like everything was, I guess, you know, meant to be that way. So Araneda immediately recorded an interview, which is also extraordinary because he interviewed all the witnesses, the seven soldiers and the corporal, 1 hour after the incident. Almost never happened, right? I mean,
right.
At best takes a couple of days or something. Mm-hmm. Here, they were interviewed instantly. Well, since the guy was not in the army, he went back to Arica, which is the main city in that area. It's a port. And he told the local newspaper there called Estrella, the Arica Star. So they were ready to publish it. But because it was a military dictatorship, the governor of Arica, who was a military man, censored the story. However, the press was fed up with censorship at the time because everything was being censored after the coup. This was the, you know, the military coup in 1973. And the press had to go along with political stories. You know, they couldn't fight the military on that. But this was a UFO story. This was different. And this time there was pressure on the government saying, enough, we've been censored and everything else, let us publish. And finally the military, about a month later, they gave in and they allowed us in. They probably did a mistake because by censoring, they just increased the value of the story. Mm-hmm. So finally, it was published front page all over the main newspapers.
Wow.
Like Mercurio, which would be like the New York Times, the Washington Post, front page everywhere. The whole transcript of the interview with that Araneda had done with the soldiers. And that's how I got hold of the story. Many years later, I did try to interview the Valdez, but he was still in the army and I could not locate him.
Mm-hmm.
Another big newspaper did. They got official permission from the army to interview him, but he didn't say anything. He said, now it's not the time to talk or whatever. I mean, they went through the charade that he was going to be interviewed, but maybe they told him, you know, be polite, but don't say anything. Or maybe he didn't want to talk. Who knows?
Wow.
But nothing was obtained from that interview.
So
after he was retired, he did go on TV and he did, there he was interviewed. Properly.
Oh, he was interviewed.
Yeah.
And did he say anything about that missing time? Did he have any?
No, he still doesn't remember. It's a missing time, but it's a gaining time. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very strange. And in all the years that I did ufology all over the world, I only found one case that was identical. And it happened in China in 1975. It was almost identical. It was also not a patrol, but there were the guards at a military regiment. But I guess it was a big location, and there was a big distance between the gate and the, you know, the actual buildings. And there were two guys, and one also was disappeared. And then they found him like in the middle of the forest, and he also had a growth on his beard and everything. But the interesting thing is, neither case could have influenced the other. The 75 case in China could have not influenced the Valdez case because it wasn't published until the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody knew about that case. And there was no way that some guys in the north of Chile could have known about a case in China that wasn't even published.
Mm-hmm.
And vice versa, the Chinese case could have not been influenced by the Chilean case because it happened before.
Right.
So that's the only similarity that I found. So anyway, after going back now to New York, so I published this article.
Right.
Now my curiosity is, you know, triggered.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I could have never thought that I say, well, now I'm going to become a ufologist. You know, it didn't happen that way. But, I mean, when you're a journalist, you deal with all kinds of stories.
Right.
And you may become very involved for a month or something. You're doing an investigative report about something else. Then you move on to the next story and then the next story. But somehow this is a weird phenomenon, as you know, and once your curiosity is triggered, you know, is awoken, and then you want to see, well, what is this?
You get that compulsion, the bug.
What's the bottom of this? So then a few things happened. Well, first, this was the time when I remember there was shortly after I published my article on the Chilean patrol, I was still writing some columns for a Chilean daily newspaper from New York, and the Blue Book files had been published, some of them, by Brad Steiger. I put out a pocket book, it was called Project Blue Book. Since I was still somewhat skeptic, I figured, well, if anything credible, if you know, the Air Force looks like a credible source, so this looks like a good book to read. So I read it. And even though people laugh about Blue Book and said it was skeptical, but on the contrary, after I read the whole book, I convinced me that there was something.
Yeah, because, great cases.
Yeah, the great cases, number one. And number two, my thinking at the time was, well, if there was nothing to UFOs, why did the Air Force keep this project going for 22 years?
Mm-hmm.
So that was one thing. Then the timing was just right. Now we're in 1977, 1978. And you mentioned earlier, there was the famous, in your introduction, there was the famous hearing at the United Nations.
Right.
And this was the only really official event that ever happened at the United Nations. There were lectures. I myself gave a lecture there a couple of times. But these lectures that me and many other ufologists, John Mack and Linda Howe and Stan Friedman.
Well, and how does that happen? How do you get to lecture at the UN?
Well, there's two things. This was an official event, and we'll get back to it in a minute.
Right.
The others were basically the UN, like any large organization, have employee organizations.
Mm.
So you get to lecture at the UN if you're invited by one of the employee associations. And it then is run by something called the UN Staff Recreational Council.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be anything. It can be a soccer game, can be a science fiction movie club, can be a chess club, yoga classes, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously it doesn't have an official status. This is just that in my case, it was a group called the Parapsychology Association or Society. Parapsychology Society. It was run by an Egyptian translator called Mohammed Ramadan.
Hmm.
And he was fascinated by UFOs. They later changed the name to SEAT. And basically, they were inviting speakers.
How many people would attend those types of lectures?
Well, it varies. Sometimes they were actually held at the Doc Hammarskjöld Auditorium, which is an actual auditorium for several hundred people.
Mm-hmm.
There was even a symposium held there in around 1992, I believe. And they had hundreds of people. I lecture once there, too, so that could be attended by many people. The others were usually in briefing rooms. And
how many people did you get, 10, 20,000?
No. Well, at the big lecture...
Well, that's travesty.
At the one at the auditorium, I forgot how many I got. There might have been 100, 150.
Neat. Well, that's still interesting.
What's interesting, of course, being inside the UN, and this is all pre-9/11, it was much easier to walk in the UN and all that, so you could invite some guests. Some outside guests. The only thing that was particularly interesting of doing that in the UN is like you would put notices on the elevators and all that, and you could theoretically, anybody that worked in the building could attend. They were free, so you could have an ambassador or someone like that if it was interested, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But they absolutely had no official status. In other words,
right.
they didn't go into the proceedings of the UN, there were no transcripts made. It was just for the employees.
Mm-hmm.
But some UFO speakers, they made a big PR about it, and they made it sound like they were giving, you know, big briefings and things, but that's not true.
Now, I'm going to put that in your bio. Briefed the UN. Hey, you were there.
Informally, you can say.
Yeah.
Now, in 1978, it was a different story. Now you had a head of state, in this case, Sir Eric Gehry from the little island of Grenada in the Caribbean. And this man was obsessed with UFOs. He had tried to initially involve the Organization of American States, which is the local organization for the Americas. They didn't give him the time of the day. Anyway, it was a very small country, had just become independent, had only about 100,000 people, population, but it still was a member of the UN. And when the General Assembly comes, all the head of states get to talk. And as a head of state, you can talk whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
So he brought up the UFO subject. And what he wanted to do was to create a UFO study group out of the Outer Space Committee. And they actually made an official motion. Well, this was in 1977, the initial stage, and to create this. And they passed what is called a resolution, 43, 42-44, something like that. I don't have the papers in front of me, but that is an official document. And it was sent to many countries. Most countries ignored it. There were a few that responded. India, interestingly enough, was one of the countries that responded. Lukewarm, but at least responded. There were a couple of other small islands, Seychelles, whatever, responded. And then in 1978, he convened this hearing at the UN Political Special Committee. This was a totally official meeting. There were transcripts. You can still get the transcripts from the UN. And he had a panel of experts there, and including Dr. Alan Hynek and Jacques Vallée. Gordon Cooper, the astronaut, also was involved, but not at that hearing. But previously, they had a private meeting with the Secretary General, who was an Austrian called Kurt Waldheim. And Gordon Cooper was present there. There was a witness, Lieutenant Colonel Coyne, the famous helicopter case in Ohio, 1973.
Well, and I should mention, I guess, for those who don't know, with Gordon Cooper, he had a sighting where he saw a craft land and filmed it at, was it Nellis?
Edwards.
Edwards Air Force Base. Well, film was confiscated.
Yeah, well, he had two sightings. He had the first sighting, because this is all in his biography.
The first was
in Germany.
Chasing UFOs. Germany.
Yeah, as a fighter pilot in Germany, he saw UFOs. And then in the one in Edwards, he didn't see it, but he saw the film.
Right.
And he heard the stories from the, and there was a UFO that landed on a dry lake bed. And I wouldn't say the film was confiscated. He was ordered by his superiors to be put in a container and sent to Washington, to the Pentagon.
Right.
That was the end of it. Yeah, Gordon Cooper, I met him, actually. I had the honor of meeting him at the conference in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, at the MUFON conference that used to be put in New Hampshire. The only time, that, to my knowledge, that he actually spoke at a UFO conference.
Wow. And, who else was that at the UN?
Oh, well, other than Coyne, Vallée, that was it, I think, the speakers.
Okay.
Now, there was another man who was involved previously with Prime Minister Gehry, but him and Hynek didn't get along, and he was a very colorful personality, and his name was Kolman von Kivinsky, and he was one of my UFO mentors, really.
Really?
He was a Hungarian colonel, and he had a small organization in New York called ICUFON, Intercontinental UFO Network, and he was a great guy, very, very colorful guy.
Why didn't him and Hynek get along?
Because Coleman was very blunt. He was a military man, and so he believed in he believed in saying things, you know, like without any preambles or. And Hynek was the opposite. He was a very cautious man, and so initially Coleman had been involved with Gehry, but then when Hynek became involved, Hynek made it a condition that I'll work with you, but no Coleman. So Coleman was evicted, basically. He was at the press conference, so there was a press conference, and he made trouble there because Coleman was a character like that. And unfortunately, what happened then came 1979. Maybe this thing would have gone somewhere, although Grenada had no influence. I also believe that this, even though this was at the height of the Cold War, that here was an issue where both the U.S. and the Soviet Union agreed, and they... Neither superpower wanted this, so neither, and they basically controlled the UN back in those days. So the thing was quixotic, you know. It would have.
Isn't there a story where who was the guy? I'm sorry, who sponsored it again?
Gehry, Grenada.
Eric Gehry. Wasn't there a story where he witnessed an abduction in New York?
No, that's a different story.
That's
the Linda case. That's the Bud Hopkins case, and that is not him, but the Secretary General, allegedly, Pérez de Cuellar, who was the guy who came after Waldheim. But that's another story. Now, in 1979, Sir Eric Gehry was overthrown in a military coup in Grenada. He was all the time doing his UFO lobby. Apparently, he wasn't taking very good care of business as a head of state. Even though he was their George Washington, you know, he was the first leader of the independent country of Grenada, but he was overthrown. Now, of course, many conspiracy people would say, well, the U.S. had their hands. But this conspiracy I do not believe for a simple reason. The people who overthrown Gary were Marxists. And were in the middle of the Cold War, and they were Marxists, and they invite the Cubans. And I cannot think, even on the UFO issue, that you would have the CIA.
They would probably rather have a UFO enthusiast than a,
exactly,
than a communist.
Exactly. A UFO enthusiast with no influence than a communist country. And in fact, as you know, or probably, I don't, well, I guess you should, you probably know this, 1984, I think, Reagan invaded Grenada. We sent the Marines there to get rid of the Marxists. Because then there was a second coup, and they killed the guy who had, his name was Maurice Bishop, the guy that had overthrown Gary. And the second coup, they were much more hardcore. The first one was sort of a soft Marxist. The second ones were total Marxists. So the this was under Reagan and Weinberger, and those people said, no way, now we're going into... They found some excuse that there were some American students at a medical school or something, and, quote, to say, you know, protect their lives, we send a huge flotilla, and of course it took, you know, about one day to invade the country, or half a day, and that was it. So, unfortunately, after this whole... episode, nobody, no other country has wanted to touch the issue of UFOs in the United Nations. On the other hand, the resolution that was passed under Gary is still in the books. So now that everybody's talking about exopolitics, that would be the move. You have to actually, we have to lobby, find a country, and it could be a small country. And at one time we thought we had a candidate, which was the little Republic of San Marino in Italy, which is actually an independent country. There was a hope at one time that they would take the banner, you know, from Grenada and revive this resolution.
Well, maybe if they're a small enough country, all of us ufologists can get together. Maybe we could get MUFON. They got a few thousand people. And we hold a coup, take over one of the small countries. In the-
yeah, they're city-sized countries, you know. Well, San Marino, for instance. But San Marino didn't go for it either. We did sign a thing called the San Marino Charta, or Carta, you know, a document. It was, this was back in, now we're moving from 78 to 98.
Well, what was your role in the UN?
No, basically, at that time, that was it. I just went there as a journalist, basically.
Okay.
Yeah. It was open to the public. The hearing was open to the public. And I attended it. I was a nobody in ufology back then.
Were you covering it?
I wrote a couple of articles for the, I guess it was the Chilean papers at the time. Yeah, and maybe some small alternative paper in New York or something. But that's it. I was that was even before I started writing for the UFO magazines. Around 1979, thanks to the, I think it was around 79. 78, no, well, somewhere in the late 70s, I sort of caught the tail end of the what they used to be the pulp era UFO magazines. Remember Saga, UFO Report? There was one called Ideals UFO Magazine. They were very, you know, low budget, but nevertheless, they were on newsstands. And they paid and everything. And I did write for several of those magazines until they went out of business by, like, the early 80s. I also wrote for some international magazines. Thanks to the connections that Coleman Ponkiewicz had internationally, I got some connections to write for Spanish magazines, Mundo Desconocido, which was a big magazine. And I also wrote some other articles for Chilean newspapers. And eventually I wrote for a New York paper too, the New York City Tribune, where I had a science column. I was mostly writing about NASA and, you know, exploration of Mars and whatever. It's mainstream scientific issue. But luckily for me, my editor was open-minded about UFOs. And so every so often, I would squeeze a UFO story. And then in the 90s, I was writing all over the place. I was writing for, I was a Fate columnist for 10 years for Fate magazine on UFOs. And I was writing for big Spanish magazines, and I wrote for, I had a couple of stories in Omni, all over the place.
So at what point did you get involved with Rockefeller's briefing document?
Yeah, this would have been around 1990, maybe I was 95 probably.
Okay.
I was approached in 1995. I was working for the Japanese at the time. I had some big contracts in Japan. I went there three times, and there were some pretty exciting projects. And I remember that Bootsy, as they call her, Marie Goldberg, who was the wife of Evan Goldberg, who passed away recently. He had been a candidate for governorship of New York. He was an important man in New York, and a banker, investment banker, and so on. He was ambassador of France, in France, during Ronald Reagan. He was the American ambassador in Paris, the husband. Marie Goldberg was very interested in UFOs, and she and Sandy Wright, a dear friend of mine, who was also involved in the early stages, they approached me. They had already Don Berliner, you know, the aviation writer and all member of NICAP and the Fund for UFO Research, had written the original draft of the UFO briefing document, the best available evidence. But it needed some revamping, and it needed more international cases, and it needed a serious rewriting, in their opinion. And so I think I was recommended by various people. And so they came to me. I remember I had an office at one of the Japanese projects. Unfortunately, I was very busy at the time, so I had to turn it down because I was under pressure to finish some major projects for a laser disc on UFOs, and I just realistically I couldn't do it. But I said, but this is going to end, you know, within 6 months or something, this project will end, and then I might be able to help you. So sure enough, the project did end. And I think I contacted them, and they said, yeah, now's why we really need you, because now we have this draft, and it needs to be worked on. So I went to work for them, and I actually worked at the office that Marie Goldberg had in Madison Avenue for a few months, and we basically got that report out. We finished the report. I rewrote considerably the original manuscript, and it was finally completed in December of 95, and it was really sent to the VIPs and members of Congress and all that in early 1996.
Yep.
And it was only 1,000 copies. Mm-hmm. And I think we have the cover. I don't know if it's in your file.
Oh yeah, we do have a cover that maybe they can show on.
And
the web in there.
Basically, that was it. Unfortunately, there were a couple of things that happened with this project, and one is that I never understood well why this happened, because they invested quite a bit of money, and it was a long-term project, and this, of course, was one of many things that Rockefeller funded, but this was one of them. And yet, even though it was supposed to be like a lobbying document, basically, to be sent to important people, there was no policy whatsoever to PR. To do PR.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the whole point. You do a document, and then you have to pressure the people, you know, if you want to accomplish something.
Well, it sounded like, I mean, in looking at, like, Grant Cameron's presidential UFO website, it seemed like he just wanted a document that he could give to his Rockefeller, his colleagues and the people he was trying to influence to do something, such as the Clintons.
Right. But there was no policy whatsoever. I remember Marie Goldberg did not want to deal with the media.
Mm-hmm.
She was almost terrified of having to deal with the media. And we had media coming because the word got out, mostly thanks to Mike Luckman, who was a PR man. And he, since there was a void, he basically filled that void, and he released the news. It was funny. I actually was angry with him at the time because, you know, I was a member of the thing, and he wasn't. And he was releasing it like if he had written the document, you know, he was sending it to the Page Six and the New York Post and the Daily News and everywhere. And we had there was no policy. There was nothing had been discussed.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like, well, all of Rockefeller's involvement was really not public.
Well, no, of course. Rockefeller was always under the scene.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was his thing. However, oddly enough, so in the U.S. had very little official impact. I mean, it went to the Clinton administration people, but nothing happened there.
Mm-hmm.
It went to several congressmen. I believe Henry Kissinger received a copy. He was he was on the mailing list. Colin Powell received a copy. So some people like that did get it,
mm-hmm.
but there was no follow-up, nothing. Some of these people wrote Marie Goldbreath courtesy letters, you know, I mean, polite letters saying, you know, acknowledging receipt. Oh, yeah, no, that picture is good you're showing it, because this document had, however, impact, to my knowledge, in at least two places. One was in France, and the other one was in Chile. In France, what happened is Marie Goldbreath, as I mentioned earlier, was the wife of the American ambassador. So, and she had lived in Paris for years, so she knew everybody. She knew Chirac, everybody. And obviously, if you were the wife of the American ambassador, you're going to know everybody, you know. So the document had maximum distribution in France with important people. We also had the cooperation of the French space agency, the CERPAN, which now, as you know, the documents are all online.
Well, and who is the gentleman on the picture?
Well, the gentleman in the picture, so that was in France. And in France, eventually, it led, I think it had an influence to the... to their own report, which was the Cometa report.
Ah, gotcha.
Because everybody that was in Cometa had copies of our document. In fact, it's mentioned in the bibliography and in the text. They hardly mentioned my name or Berliner. They give all the accolades to Marie Goldbreath, you know, because they knew her.
Yeah.
Then I was going to Chile at that time, too, very often, because it was a boom in ufology in Chile. There were many symposiums sponsored by universities and all kinds of things. And... it so happened that in Chile, there was an effort was brewing to create an official committee in the government to study UFOs. And in that picture that we just showed, I'm handing the document, well, he's reading it, but I had just handed a copy of the document to General Ramon Vega, who was a former commander-in-chief of the Chilean Air Force, who at the time was a senator. There he's reading the report. He actually has the page where there's the famous painting of the Virgin Mary and the UFO, you know, from the 15th century in Florence. Yeah. So this was just good timing. These people were trying to convince their own government that UFOs were a worthwhile phenomenon to pursue. And here was this very elegant report. We're not talking of the paperback edition. That was put many years later by Whitley Strieber, you know, as a paperback, as a pocketbook. This was elegant with the blue cover and all that, and it really looked like an official document.
Oh, yeah, I get real, you know, I hadn't seen that until you showed that to me.
Yeah, there's no comparison.
Oh,
the
other
one looked
beautiful.
Like a regular UFO book, you know. This,
I want a copy so bad.
We'll try to get you. And so the timing was just great. It wasn't meant to be that way. It's just the way it happened.
Yeah.
I gave them the document, and they were amassing all the arguments, and they presented the arguments to the Chilean government, and sure enough, the Air Force went along, and they created a small unit out of the air control association, you know, organization, and they have offices there.
You know, originally I had felt a little negatively towards the Rockefeller document, and the reason why is when I really got into this, when I found Greer's document, briefing document, I was extremely excited, and especially because he makes that free on his website to download, and so it was widely distributed.
Right.
Unlocked the Rockefeller, and I was, you know, you get in that conspiratorial mindset, and you think, was Rockefeller trying to suppress what Greer was trying to do?
But actually, Rockefeller didn't have the copyright. Was actually the three main UFO organizations.
Mm-hmm.
So if there was an effort to suppress it,
it was
coming from us.
Yeah.
Not from me, because I was all for having it out.
And what were those three organizations?
Well, there was the Coalition for UFO Research.
Mm-hmm.
And this, the history of this goes, because back in those days, I was MUFON too, as you know, in the old days. I was the international coordinator, although I didn't have much clout anyway, but I tried. But back in those days, it was the first time they got some money from Bigelow.
Mm-hmm.
But Bigelow said, I'm not going to give you money to one organization or the other. You have to create an umbrella organization, and then I will give you the money to the three of them. So they created this coalition. It was called the Coalition for UFO Research, and it was formed by MUFON, the Fund for UFO Research, and CUFOS. And if you read the Rockefeller document, the best available evidence, it's signed by the three directors at the time, which I think was Dick Hall for the Foo Four, Walt Andrews for MUFON, and what's his name for Kufos? I forgot his name.
Yeah. But bringing up that subject.
Rodiger, Mark Rodiger from Kufos.
Bringing up the subject of Greer in the briefing document, just because not a lot of people have much insight into that, but you do. You were
sure,
there.
Sure, I was there.
And I know it might be hard to choose your words to be diplomatic about it, but you know, how would you explain what happened there?
Well, what happened in part was that, first of all, Greer had received money from Rockefeller previously. Rockefeller, like I said, had funded many things, and he funded quite a bit of large sums of money to Greer to do the beginning of the earlier days of the Disclosure Project, basically the witnesses, to go around the world and locate witnesses and interview them. I guess Greer had proposed a briefing document at one time, but then the thing changed, and now Marie Goldberg was in charge, and even though she had been friends with Greer, but Berliner and these guys wouldn't work with Greer, so he had nothing to do with our document. Now, Greer, when the document was finally published, was very mad, basically, and he said that basically it was, I don't know if he used the word plagiarism or something like that, but it was, first of all, he objected to the title, briefing document. A briefing document is a standard name for any government document, you know.
I think that's the title he chose.
It's generic.
Initially.
Yeah, but it's generic. A briefing document is generic. You cannot say, well, that's my title, you know. I mean, any organization briefing another head of state or something does a briefing document. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't make it. There's no legs to that complaint. The other complaint was that we had supposedly used a lot of the material, but that is also ridiculous because we use the same documents that everybody has. I mean, Greer doesn't have a hold over the Strategic Air Force incidents of 1975 or the Iran case of 1976 or the Colonel Holt memo. I mean, I had those documents back in the 70s, long before Greer was even in the map, and so did Berliner. So we really didn't use any material. We used material that was also used by Greer and was used by Timothy Good and it was used by Cometa. I mean, the documents are the same. So Greer made a big fuss. In my opinion, I don't think he behaved very well because he had received money also from Rockefeller. So you don't bite at the hands that feed you, number one. Number two, he didn't have much of a case. Fortunately, I wasn't involved in that aspect.
Right.
Yeah. Well, then I think Greer was also giving copies of the document or something, and then Berliner objected, and I think they threatened him with lawyers or something like that. There was a whole battle. But
you know,
like I said, I was not involved, not with that part of it.
Behind the scenes in ufology, maybe sometimes not so behind the scenes in ufology, there's lots of fighting going on. But, I mean, it was still good. I think it is still great that Greer at least continued on and got his document so well distributed.
Well, he did his thing. We did ours. There were some similarities and some ours was much more conservative.
Yeah.
Because ours was really meant to be sent to all these people and for them to really read it carefully.
Well, it was sent to the administration, I mean, and now from Presidential UFO
Week.com,
we can see that.
It actually appears in some of these documents about the Rockefeller Initiative, yes.
Well, and we can see that, you know, Rockefeller was working with Hillary Clinton and through her office.
Well, you know, Rockefeller himself had not any input in the drafting of our documents. Nobody ever pressured us, and I know because I was working
That's
there.
What I've heard from everybody he funded. He gave them money.
Yeah.
They did their
own
thing.
Never heard anything like saying, well, you ought to discuss this and not that. No. Marie Goldberg, on the other hand, yes, she was sort of the project coordinator. And she was the one seeing Rockefeller. But given from what I know of him and the way he dealt with later with the Sturrock report. Yeah, basically, like you say, he would give the money and then let people do what they would do with it. So,
and then, well, let's move on to your book on Russian UFOs.
Well, that was an old one, actually. That was much earlier than the Rockefeller one.
When was that?
That was published in 1991, probably.
And how'd you get involved with it?
Well, that actually came when at the very tail end of the Soviet Union, because it's still called, and we have the cover there somewhere, too. It's out of print now, but...
Antonio, are you a communist?
No, that initially came about in, I guess, two ways. One was I attended a very large symposium that Michael Hesseman put in Frankfurt, Germany, in 1989. And it was one of the largest symposiums I ever attended. It had way over 1,000 people.
Wow.
And
where was that?
Frankfurt.
Wow.
Everybody important from the United States was there. Friedman, Bud Hopkins, Wendell Stevens, and Coleman von Kavinsky, and many more. And they were people from all over the world. But what was unusual for that time is that for the first time ever, we had a big delegation from the Soviet Union. And this had really never happened, because in the Cold War, there was absolutely no contact between Russian ufologists and the West. Occasionally, the West, some article would appear in the Russian press, you know. And
even now it doesn't happen too much.
Yeah, but now you can certainly go on the internet or whatever and talk to people. I mean, nothing stops them. But back then, it was really impossible.
Yeah.
I think occasionally someone would have with one letter, and it was like a rare thing. But then came Gorbachev in the 80s, in the late 80s, and the Russian society opened up. And the press, the Soviet media, opened up. And one of the things that opened up like crazy was the UFO issue. And you were there, of course. You were the stage manager at the recent crash retrieval conferences in Las Vegas. And Peter Robbins, old friend of mine, discussed the Voronezh case, or Voronezh, I think they call it. Mm-hmm. And this is a city in Russia, a large city, where this UFO landed in a park, and these very tall beings came out of the craft. And it was seen by a bunch of kids that were playing soccer or something, as well as by other adult witnesses, too. Well, there have been cases like this before. But what was interesting is that this case was picked up by the TASS news agency, and it was published all over Russia. And then it was, because it was published now openly in Russia, then it was picked up by the Western media, and it made even front page on the New York Times. Totally unheard of. And it was all over the world. Now we go, a few months later, we have this big conference in Frankfurt. And Hesseman invited all these Russian, at the time they're still Soviet, ufologists. And they came. And this was unique. And we had a Sergei Bulantsev, who had appeared on that UFO cover-up live show.
Mm.
That was an early indication that things were opening in Russia. When in an American TV show, you had two Russian ufologists live via satellite from Moscow, talking about UFOs. That, again, had never happened. But that's in 1988. Things were moving, you know. But here you had these people right there, and they gave talks and everything. A Colonel Morvin Shodro, who was a man from what was still called Leningrad, later became St. Petersburg, one of the pioneers of Russian ufologists. Uvarov, another guy from St. Petersburg. So I became friends with these guys. I figured that this was the hot story of the moment, you know, because it was so new and fresh. And I basically spent the whole, it was a very large symposium, lasted days, I forgot, 4 or 5 days. I spent all the time with them. I got a lot of material from them, and I start collecting material from Russia. And Coleman von Kavinsky, who was Hungarian, was in contact with a lot of countries in Eastern Europe. He was getting tons of material. And fortunately, there was a man who actually lives here in Tempe, Arizona. He was with MUFON, Dmitry Osipov, a great guy, originally Serbian. And he's a polyglot, because I don't read Russian. And at the time, he was living in New York City, and he made all these free translations for us. He translated all these documents. And then also I would go to the Victor Kamkin, which was the old Soviet bookstore in New York City, where they used to sell in the old days, you know, Russian propaganda books, or you could write classic literature, Tolstoy, whatever. I think it was an agreement in the Cold War, so the Americans had an American bookstore in Moscow and the Russians had one in New York and Washington or something like that. It was usually boring, you know, Soviet life, you know, how great the Soviet Union is or whatever. But then suddenly it became interesting in the 80s again with Glasnost.
Mm-hmm.
And there were all these UFO stories. I mean, I would go there like every 10 days and always find some new, even
wow.
Soviet military magazines. There was one called Soviet Soldier and another one like Air Force Times or something like that. And they had UFO series. Some was in English because it was for foreign distribution.
Mm-hmm.
Some was in Russian, but then we had Dimitri translated.
Can you remember
so,
some of these stories or some of these were more shocking?
Yeah, yeah.
What were some of them that you thought?
Some
wow.
of them were fascinating.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, just to finish the book, so
okay.
basically I assembled a lot of these stories, and it was not just on UFOs. It had chapters on cryptozoology, you know, the Russian Bigfoot, which they call Almasti, and or they have a Loch Ness type creature too in Lake Baikal.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they have one. And there was stuff about parapsychology. Of course, the Russians had a long history of parapsychology.
They have a Russian chupacabra?
Not back in those days that I know. But even in America, chupacabras wasn't around yet.
Yeah.
And we published that book. It was a small edition. It's out of print. Probably
right.
people can still find it, used copies in Amazon or somewhere. But
looks like a cool book.
Yeah.
But yeah, what were some of the big stories?
There were lots of interesting stories.
UFO-wise.
There was a fascinating story of a UFO that hovered over a train.
Mm-hmm.
You always hear about UFO interfering with cars or even airplanes, but this is the only one that I know of a train.
Right.
And there was a...
it caused the train to stop?
Yeah. I think the train was going very fast and the conductor lost control over his... And there was something in the speedometer of the train or something, too. I forgot the details, but it was fascinating. And it was published in the cover of an equivalent to, like, Popular Mechanics.
Wow.
It was a famous Russian magazine, Technika Molodasi, like Technology and Youth, I think it's called.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very popular magazine in the Soviet Union in the old days, you know, because they had a space program and to
right.
a lot of engineers, right, to get the Russian people to go into science and engineering. But here, this was cover story. That was a fascinating case, and they investigated and they looked at the machines and all that. Then there was, of course, documents that came, but that was later. That was after the Soviet Union fell, and then that's when the late cosmonaut Pavel Popovich, which we have an obituary on our forthcoming magazine, you know, Open Minds magazine. I wrote it myself. In fact, I sent him a copy of the briefing document. And I never met him personally, unfortunately, but I did have correspondence with him. He sent me a fax one time, I remember, thanking me for the briefing document. I did meet Marina Popovich, of course, who was his wife, although they later divorced. It was his first wife. He had obtained a bunch of documents from the KGB back in 91, I think, or 92.
Mm-hmm.
And these were the first official military documents that were declassified in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
It was quite a news. And we had one case in our briefing document, because it's very similar to Ben Waters or to some of the cases that Malmstrom and the other bases in the Strategic Air Command cases. Where you basically had a UFO hovered over a highly top-secret base in Kapustin Yar in central Russia, Siberia, somewhere in the middle of Russia. And there was a jet fighter sent, and it was seen by a lot of guards. And we only have a portion of the dossier. I'm sure it's much thicker.
Mm-hmm.
But the most fascinating part there is that and there's a document about it, and even an eyewitness drawing, which we published in the briefing document, where the UFO shot a beam of light at the hangar where they had nuclear weapons.
Wow.
So, and of course, like I said, that Holt, Colonel Holt, always talks about that. That was probably the most significant aspect of the Bedwaters case, at least to him as a military man. He was always, I met Colonel Holt myself, you know, a couple of times. He was always shocked why it wasn't a follow-up on this. Or probably there was, but he didn't even know. I mean, if it was, it was so secret that he didn't even find out.
And Colonel Holt, That's in relation to the Rendlesham Forest.
Rendlesham Forest, right.
And
he mentions that there were beams going into the storage mm-hmm. where the weapons were. I think it was a very delicate subject because the British public wasn't supposed to know that there were nuclear weapons there, but they were. And, you know, there was a lot of it. It was a big anti-nuclear movement in Europe mm-hmm. against the U.S., and so it was touchy. And like one, I think it was Lord Hill Norton at the House of Lords, or one of those, I think it was Lord Hill Norton who had been a chief or an admiral. He said, well, if this does not affect security, then what does?
Oh, yeah. He was very upset that there wasn't follow-up.
Yeah,
on
because
it,
the British Minister of Defense kept basically it was a classic case of each, they kept passing the buck to each other. Mm-hmm. The British were saying, well, it's not our case because it happened, even though the bases, they were the landlord, right? But all the personnel was American. So it's an American affair because the witnesses were American. Mm-hmm. The Americans said it's a British affair because it happened in Great Britain. Mm-hmm. And they kind of kept passing the buck to each other.
Yep. One of the stories, speaking of the Russian files, not to debunk, but I think that it's important, some of the information you have that I hadn't heard before about...
The Navy documents?
Well, the KGB files TV show with
Roger
Moore.
Oh, the TV show? Yeah.
Yeah, and some of what you and your colleagues had found about that.
Yeah, it's not one of my favorite subjects, but because unfortunately I was interviewed there.
On the show.
Yeah, I'm on the show. Well, initially I thought it was great. I mean, I had James Bond, Roger Moore.
Oh, I know.
UFO expert Antonio Huneus.
And I loved him.
And he pronounces perfectly, too, because people always mispronounce my name. So that part was good. But I had nothing to do I had no idea what this thing was all about. I was contacted through a friend. I found out that this TV show was being produced. I had, of course, published not only that book, but many articles on Soviet and Russian UFO cases. So it was natural that they would want to talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I went with Major Feiler, George Feiler.
Mm-hmm.
They flew us together to L.A. They put us in a nice hotel there, and we were interviewed. A typical TV show, they interview me for 40 minutes, and then they only use two, three clips.
Yeah.
And except for the Dalnegorsk case, which is a very interesting case, where there was something crash, and it's a legitimate case, and there are photographs.
Was that the one where there's a crash on a Russian base?
No. Okay. The Dalnegorsk case happened not on a military facility.
Okay.
That's why we know about it. This happened in 1986, and I wrote about it in the newspaper at the time when I was still writing for the New York City Tribune. And it's a fascinating case because there was a commission of, at that time, ufology in Russia was under the Academy of Sciences. And the Academy of Sciences, well, one aspect of it, the other aspect, of course, was secret. There were two commissions in Russia. One was the public one and the other one was the secret one. Mm-hmm. The public one was run by the National Academy of Sciences, which is unlike in America. In America, it's a small organization, but in Russia, it's a huge one. There's thousands of members. And so what they had committees in the major different Russian cities on what was called anomalous aerial phenomena, because they didn't want to use the name UFO because of all its connotation.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it was basically the same thing. And these people were scientists. This was it was a serious stuff. And they were very cautious and, documenting scientifically these various UFO events. Meanwhile, there was another commission, which was secret, which was run by the military and the KGB. The KGB, of course, had units, had agents in every military unit. Russian or Soviet, we're talking, any Soviet ship or regiment or battalion would have always a KGB officer
mm-hmm.
posted there to make sure that ideologically, everybody step in line and, to control the intelligence and all that. And so they were also... They had an actual committee, and they were also keeping extensive files on UFOs. Popovich obtained some of them. George Knapp, when he went to Russia in 1995 or something, also brought back a thick dossier mm-hmm. of which he gave me copies. There were some fascinating cases, including the one in what was Ukraine, Osovo, with the Osovo base, when the UFO changed the codes of the in an intercontinental ballistic missile.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And they, at one moment, it looked like the thing was lining up, and only the order could come from Moscow, you know.
So they thought maybe it was launching.
Yeah, maybe it was launching, and they had no control over it. So fortunately, it stopped, you know. And then they went crazy, and they dismantled the whole thing to see if there was any malfunction, but they couldn't find anything. The guy who was at the bunker never saw the UFO because he was in the underground bunker, but he testified to the where he lost control of the of the control panel. Meanwhile, outside, this was in 1982. This, by the way, was in prime time, 2020, one of those programs. Not 2020, prime time, I think it's
prime
called.
Time Live.
Yeah, with Sam Donaldson. Actually, that show was broadcast there. They interviewed the guy, and or one of the witnesses. And at the same time that the officer in the bunker was experiencing all this malfunction with the control panel for the nuclear weapons, the people outside were seeing UFOs hovering over the base. So that came in those documents that George Knapp obtained. And then, most recently, of course, we had this news about the release of the Navy documents.
Well, just we'll touch on that, but, I mean, I wanted to follow up, just so people know, I think it's important people know when they're being deceived. And with those KGB files, the show hosted
The show.
Yeah.
So I go to this TV production in Hollywood, Associated Independent Television, and they show me, Filer and I, this footage. I had never seen of it, never heard of it. And I give my opinion, you know, yeah, I said, it looks very clear. It looks the best we have, if it's real. Mm-hmm. But then, unfortunately, in the beginning of the show, they cut, you know, if it's real, so
right.
I appear like endorsing it. Later, they do show the full clip. Well, eventually, though, I was very suspicious. It was an exciting program, no question about it. And they did interview some people in Russia that were, we know they exist, like Adinsky, who's a friend of mine, one of the Russian ufologists, appears in that show. But unfortunately, there's so many holes in that story. And the main, well, they mentioned a guy called Vereshchagin, who's supposed to be a Russian expert, who was the expert on this case and wrote a book about it. Now, it's weird. I know all the Russian ufologists. I know it's a big country, but, I mean, I heard of it. Well, not only me, even all the Russian, nobody has ever heard of this guy. And, you know, he didn't exist.
Or his book.
There was no book. The book was never published. The guy never existed. So once you get that, you already have a bad start. And everything kind of fall apart. There's the business with the... They claim that this UFO crash, right?
With the neat video with the
the turtle kind of looking. Yeah, and then they take the being... to some medical facility, I forgot in which city, Leningrad, I guess, and the three doctors do the autopsy and stuff. It was obviously a copycat of the Santilli, you know, because that had such a success that this company figured, hey, we'll do one in Russia, and it'll be much harder to verify things in Russia, so we'll get away with it. And that's my guess. But in any case, they have these doctors, supposedly, make the autopsy of the being. And then they claim that the three doctors died of radiation sickness or something, like within weeks. They show the documents of the death certificates. Years later, this would have happened like in 1968 or something like that. So that was the Soviet Union. So the death certificate should have said Soviet Russian Republic. You remember? Because it was the Union of Socialist Soviet Republics. But, of course, it's in Cyrillic alphabet, so for us it doesn't make a difference. But the Russian guys that looked at this could tell that what the producers were careless, and they used current documents, death certificates from the new Russia. So it says, instead of Soviet Russian Republic, it said Russian Federated Republic. Well, that's after the fall of the Soviet Union, that document could not be valid for 1968. That's one thing. There is a whole host of issues like that has to do with the insignias and the military uniforms and this and that. So to me, the whole thing is a hoax, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And
yeah, that is unfortunate, but it's always good to find that out. I mean, for instance, I've been talking about this picture in 1952 of the buzzing of the White House.
And right.
It was great to have you tell me that actually, yeah, you know, we found out those are lens flares.
Lens flares, and it's not taken in 1952, but
yeah,
like in 1959 or something like that, or even the 60s. We have the report, both Marisa and I, we have different reports. I have the report that was prepared by Komen von Kavinsky, who was a photo analyst for the Hungarian army. He was creator of the audiovisual department of the Hungarians in the 1930s. So he knew all about photography, and he was totally pro-UFO. So you cannot say this guy's a debunker or whatever.
Right.
He was a, you know, a firm believer in UFOs. Yet he was honest in that case, and he discovered that he was lens flares. Mauricio has a similar report that was done by some Italian professor who came, without each knowing of each other, came exactly to the same conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, unfortunately, there's a lot of false information in UFOs.
Yeah.
And it doesn't help our case, you know, if we promote everything as a true UFO.
I like to get as much information out to people as possible.
Yeah.
But, let's move on then to those Navy.
I'm still really trying to track down the story of the Navy. The only my only sort of personal thing there is that when this story came out just about 2 months ago, right, I had just started working for Open Minds. Mauricio put me in charge of the news section for our magazine. And I said, well, obviously this is one of the main stories. We had, of course, good old McKinnon there as well.
And luckily, he's not going anywhere.
Yeah, so. I had to revise that story like 3 times, you know, before we closed the magazine.
And now you have to revise it again.
So it's too late now. I think we're practically going. We finished with the text for the magazine. But anyway, going back to the Russians. So they were all quoting Dr. Vladimir Ajaja. And Dr. Ajaja, probably most of your listeners are not familiar with him.
Great name,
but,
Ajaja.
Ajaja, yeah. But he's one of the great legendary ufologists in Russia. Originally, it was Dr. Ziegel, who was a professor at the Moscow Aviation Institute, and he was really the founding father of Russian ufology. But he passed away in 1988. And the other figure was Ajaja. He's 80. Oh, yes, I am there with him and Marina Popovich. And this was in an interview done in Tokyo in 1991. They were
neat.
Yeah. So I met both of them, and I interviewed the good old doctor. He's much older now. And Ajaja was a submarine captain. And he's also an oceanographer. So his expertise, his professional expertise, is the oceans. He later became an ufologist. He drafted the questionnaire, the UFO reporting form, for the Russian Merchant Marine.
Oh.
He did that. So when the story came out, he was quoted in all these Russian news sources, because he's obviously an expert. And he gives the percentage. He says that a large number of cases in Russia, as well as everywhere else, but he's specifically talking of Russia, happened in bodies of water, where it's lakes or UFOs or big rivers. So, but the one I have not, I'm still working on that story, and I will, as soon as we got news on it, we will, of course, post it on our website. We're still trying to get hold of the actual documents. We have not seen the documents themselves. Now, I think that part of it is that the Russian, yes, it's great that they're releasing, and I assume this is true because it was reported all over the Russian press. So, and I didn't hear any denial, you know, so I'm sure they're released, but they're not like the French or the British or even the Brazilians who now, or the Danish, where all these other countries now, when they're releasing the documents, they're almost immediately posting them online. I think the Russian Navy is a little bit more, they don't want probably lots of people going online to their site or whatever, so you probably have to request them by letter or something, or go read them at their library or something like that. But if they are declassified, sooner or later, we'll get hold of them.
Yep.
So I still have not seen the actual documents. I was looking for some of the documents that we have, you know, from the George Knapp dossier, and I did find a couple once from Navy. But most of those documents are Air Force, though. So,
well, in 91, Popovich.
Popovich. Those were mostly Air Force, too.
Okay. Weren't there some Navy ones there, at least one in there?
I'm not sure.
Okay. Okay.
I'm not sure. We do have in my files, there are some other cases with Navy. So we will be posting soon some additional material.
Yeah. I know I had received when we sent out that message about those files, Bruce McAbee said that a Japanese researcher had told him about at least one of those Navy Russian stories back in the 90s.
From the Popovich? It could be, because I don't have the entire dossier of the Popovich either. There were like 135 documents, and I only have, I don't know, a few dozen.
Mm-hmm.
So it's possible. I do have, I believe, an index of it. I would have to take a look at it. Navy, now, going back to Chile now, there was an interesting story, too, of a former commander-in-chief of the Chilean Navy who gave a TV interview a few years ago, about 2002 maybe, something like that, and his name is Martinez Bush, no relation to
George.
And this man, former commander-in-chief of the Navy, and Chile is a very long country with a very long Navy, you know, very rich naval tradition, because it's so much ocean, and we have the father of the Chilean Navy, the British admiral, actually, Lord Cochrane, and from the days of the War of Chilean Independence in the 1810s and 20s. So in any case, this guy goes on TV and he tells the reporter that, yes, there are many cases in the Chilean Navy with UFOs. And when I was a young officer, I had two experiences. And then he goes and he tells his experiences. And
that's incredible. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, when you have a former commander-in-chief, you know. But we haven't seen documents. There were, I think you mentioned in one of your earlier TV shows, radio shows, there was some videos were released by the Chilean military, by this commission that is connected to the Air Force. And not actually an Air Force. It's connected to the Air Traffic Control Organization, which in Chile, as in many countries, is under the umbrella of the Air Force.
Okay.
And they released some videos, most of which I had seen already. It's the same thing, you know, with the Brazilian documents. Everybody's talking about the Brazilian documents, which, thanks in part to A.J. Gevaer, you know, he's obtained. And now it's true. They're releasing all these documents, and Gevaer is putting them online. And, you know, that's great, because everybody can access them. But the truth is that most of those documents I already had. A lot of this is happening with a lot of these releases of documents. What happened is in the old days, a lot of these countries did not have like freedom equivalent to our Freedom of Information Act. So what would happen is that occasionally a general or someone would informally de facto declassify documents and give them to some ufologist or some organization or some scientist, saying, "Oh yeah, you want to know about that airliner case or whatever? Well, here's the documents." And so once the documents were, you know, available, someone had them, then they would photocopy them, and then everybody would have them. But they were not part of a legal process,
official
process.
Right.
So although I think there's some new documents in the Brazilian, but a lot of the ones that I had already seen, I had them. And I believe this is the case. The Canadian documents, this is not new. The Canadian government had been releasing documents for many years. They're probably releasing, it's an ongoing process. So even the British Ministry of Defense, had released previously.
Right. But, and that gets me excited talking about this stuff, because we're probably due for another batch of British files pretty soon here.
Yeah.
So hopefully they come soon. And remember, download them quick.
Yes, otherwise you have to pay the Queen.
Yep, or else you're going to have to pay the Queen.
The Queen, Her Majesty's stationery.
Yep. And don't forget, those are copyrighted by the Queen.
That is so weird.
You can't use their files.
The only government on earth that actually puts a copyright on official documents. An official document, it's not a commercial thing, you know. I mean, it's paid by taxpayers.
Yeah.
But the British do put a copy, the Crown copyright, it's called.
That's funny.
Although, I don't think that they pursued anybody. I mean, once the documents are out, people just
haven't heard of anything
them, you know?
Like that.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to talk about, I guess, plug some stuff we're doing with Open Mind.
Sure.
Such as some of the topics of the stories that you've written in the magazine. And people, keep an eye on the website, because we'll have the magazine probably up in the next couple of weeks where you'll be able to download our magazine, but What were some of the stories you have in there?
Well, basically, as you know, our listeners probably don't know that, but I mean, I've only been here for a little bit over 2 months.
Yeah.
So I came after you. You know, of course, Mauricio was here, the first one.
Mm-hmm.
And so by the time I got here, he already had put most of the magazine, but I took care of all the little sections. So I did the news stories. But of course, the news stories, because news is the one element, I call it perishable. You know,
yeah.
I mean, if you wait too many months, by the time your publication comes, and this used to happen to print magazines all the time, you know,
yeah.
monthly or bi-monthly magazines. So we decided to put most of them on the web. So that was a story about the Japanese First Lady and mm-hmm. her comments, and the Russian Navy one, and the Chinese eclipse footage.
Yeah.
But when people get the magazine, they'll see those stories. Then I did a few other sections too. Unfortunately, this is not a happy section, but it's still important. The memorial page, we
yeah.
call it, and we had. I wrote all of that. We had tribute to people like John Michel and John
yeah.
Keel and Richard Hall.
Well,
and
a lot of the major researchers are getting really old.
Exactly, our field has been long enough now that this is. It may be a regular feature. It's just. Nature, right?
Mm-hmm.
Of the major of the feature stories, I only have one major story there, and it's a very interesting one. I interviewed a filmmaker, Randall Nickerson, who was a friend of the late John Mack and also Bob Hopkins, and he reopened that famous case at the Ariel School in Rua, Zimbabwe. Remember with the UFO that landed and the aliens
mm-hmm.
came and 62
all kids,
children, all the kids. So it's a really fascinating case. And even though John Mack had worked on it, and I think it was his intention to do a documentary after his untimely death, that was left unfinished. And then Dominique Kalimopoulos, who
mm-hmm.
was working with John Mack, brought Randall Nickerson. First, the idea was that he would just edit the material and just make a documentary with what he had. What they had, what the John Mack Institute had. But when he saw this stuff, this guy got so excited and said, well, this is such an important story that we should not just use the material you have, but why don't we go back and now trace some of the witnesses who at the time they were between like 8 and 11 years old or something like that. Now they're all kids in their 20s. And interview them and also, you know, find other witnesses and so on. So I guess they approved this idea. They got some funding, and he went to South Africa, mostly to South Africa. He did, of course, go to Zimbabwe too. But because, as you know, the economic situation and the political situation is so bad in Zimbabwe,
mm-hmm.
That country is the basket case, and it's been falling apart for years. Practically all the kids that he was able to locate had all emigrated. They had all moved to South Africa
mm-hmm.
for economic reasons or political reasons or whatever,
mm-hmm.
personal reasons. So he was able to locate a lot of the witnesses.
Cool.
He located a lot of additional witnesses who had never been interviewed by Mac or by the late Cynthia Hine, also
mm-hmm.
from Zimbabwe, who originally had documented the case, or by the press, because the case got a lot of attention. The BBC was there and everything, but it was within the next, you know, the few weeks after the incident.
Yeah.
Then it was forgotten. And what he discovered is this was much bigger than what people realized.
Well, actually, I'm going to have to cut you off because we're about out of time.
Well,
but
we'll have to read it in our magazine.
They can read it in the magazine. Also, another couple great stories on the Mexican philosopher who had his
That's a really unusual story.
Yeah,
yeah.
And the Vietnam,
UFOs, yes.
Which is great because I have never seen another story on Vietnam and UFOs. And those two stories are on our website, so hopefully you're already there listening to the show. So go ahead to the front page and check those out.
Yeah, we'll be posting the review that I did also for the magazine on the James Fox.
I know what I saw. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that will be there probably tomorrow.
Great. So we're out of time. Thanks for being on the show. And actually, we'll have Mauricio in a couple of weeks because these guys I want to have on the show periodically. So, you know, if Antonio sees a movie and he wants to talk about it, we'll have him on the show and he'll share his thoughts or anything like that. So we'll have these guys on regularly. But from here on out, be sure to check out the webpage because we've always got new information and news and feature articles from all of us there. In fact, I'm going to have one up, and this is breaking on some cattle mutilations that happen again. out in Colorado. So you heard me talk about that a while ago.
I think I told you. That's the only one cattle mutilation that I kind of investigated.
It was in the San Luis Valley.
Where they started and where a lot happened.
So be sure to check us out next week. Be sure to check out the website. We won't, or 2 weeks from now, because next week is Thanksgiving. It's Turkey Day, so we'll have to take a break, and actually Maritio and Antonio are coming over to my mom's. We're going to have some Thanksgiving holiday dinner, and it'll be great. But you guys have a great Thanksgiving, and check us out in a couple weeks. Adios.